Right, well, there are three main elements that I want us to concentrate on this morning. Before we examine the text in detail, though, I would like to draw out a couple of comments on how to approach the whole incident and what to look for in the passage as a whole. So perhaps I can introduce the approach like this. If you were a television news reporter like Michael Burke or Sandy Gall, and you were asked to go out and cover a political crisis in the Middle East, perhaps you've been asked to send back a story for News at 10 or the BBC News at 6, what would your precise task be? Now, in all probability, you would take out with you a cameraman and a sound crew, and together you would aim to record as clear and as faithful a picture of the facts as you're able. You are to be accurate, objective, and you're to stick to the facts alone. But now, by contrast, imagine you are a Ludovic Kennedy or an AJP Taylor. The BBC or ITV commission you not for a news story, but to make an historical documentary, to look back at a past event, something which happened some time ago, perhaps a war in the Middle East or anywhere else for that matter. How does your task differ from the news team? The facts still matter. Accuracy is still paramount. But it is the interpretation of the facts which become the most important issue. It's a recognition of the unseen forces at work which will answer the question why all this happened and why it matters. And it's your ability to interpret these events, to discover their significance and unveil the unseen forces at work, which is the most important requirement for this type of assignment. So put simply, you have a different kind of choice to make in the way that you treat this information before you. So when we approach this passage in Joshua, we have two similar choices. We can approach this whole incident at Jericho like the news team. We can concentrate simply on the bald historical facts. Now, if that's so, we might take some footage of the Israelite army marching around Jericho, led by their religious leaders. We can have some close shots of the fortifications of the city. And if we can persuade him away for a few moments, we might just catch a few words with Joshua himself and talk to him about his military strategy. In production terms, of course, the best visual impact is going to be to get a helicopter up, to take a panoramic view of these massive walls of Jericho. Especially, of course, if we can time it right and get them to crumble and split and come tumbling down while we've got the cameras rolling. Certainly that kind of approach will make a great lead-in for the first news story of the day. And of course, this is the manner of classic news reporting. It sticks to the facts. It tells us what happened. But it does not tell us why. And for the full picture, to assess the significance of these events for us today, we do need to know why. It is more like the approach of the historical documentary. We need to know whether there are any unseen forces at work in this situation. Not only that we have a clearer understanding of the event itself, but also that we can learn and see the underlying lessons of this event to our own lives now, to apply those lessons. And that's our task this morning, to find out what is going on behind the scenes. Just a brief recap on Joshua as a whole, because it's very important to grasp the importance of the land itself. The book, as you know, is about the outworking of God's promise, that original foundation promise made to Abraham to give to God's people a land to inherit, a land where they could learn to serve and to honor God, a land where they could learn to God's ways, to follow God's ways and his commandments, a land destined to see the birth of God's own Messiah above all. A land then, as you can realize, which would ultimately serve as a springboard for the news of that salvation fulfilled by Jesus Christ to be taken to the whole world. And that is the significance, in a word, of the promised land. So the conquest of the land is clearly of inestimable importance in the progress of God's salvation. That's the subject of the book as a whole. Now, if you find it mildly discomforting or even surprising to find all this talk of violence and war in the early pages of the Bible, let me ask you to remember this. We are dealing with real history. These are events which actually happened. And the times and the people we're dealing with were rough and they were warlike by their very nature. This is a primitive era. The simple reality in those days was if Israel had not been prepared to take up arms against the vicious, attacking, warlike pagan peoples of Canaan, Israel would have been wiped out without trace, and the land fit for a Messiah would never have become theirs. So let's admit from the outset, these were rough tactics designed for rough times. And now we'll see what we can learn. Here at the end of chapter 5, we're right into the action itself. The man, he's Joshua. He's the leader that God has raised up to follow Moses. The year, it's around 1240 BC. And the place, it's Jericho. It's known today as it was all those years ago as the city of palm trees. It lies just west of the River Jordan. And Joshua is making his first thrust into the center of Palestine. And we need to ask his aim. His aim is to drive a wedge between the north and the south of the country. And Jericho as a city stands directly in his path. So it forms an obvious first target. As well as asking then what happened, we're going to be asking why it happened. And it's time to look at the text in detail. Could you please find chapter 5, verses 13 to 15, and I'll read them to you. This history of the conquest is a very striking beginning. Joshua 5, verse 13. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, a man stood before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord bid his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. Okay, here's the first of the three elements that I want to draw our attention to. Number one, Joshua received a renewed vision of the holiness of God. That's the first element, a renewed vision of the holiness of God. Here is Joshua as the supreme commander of the allied forces. He's on the threshold of a major battle. The opponent, the city of Jericho. I wonder whether you know much about the Jericho of those days. In the ancient world, Jericho had a reputation as an extremely aggressive and warlike city-state. Chapter 6 and verse 2 here talks only briefly about its mighty men of valor. But various archaeological discoveries just recently have confirmed this, and they've revealed the people of Jericho as a vicious and aggressive and also highly experienced fighting force. I want us to think about Joshua's own predicament in this situation. You may find it difficult to imagine yourself on a battleground, but try to imagine any situation where you're called on to face an immense hurdle. All the odds are pitched against you. Your scant experience and resources against their overwhelming superiority. It's not a pleasant experience, of course, being up against it, and probably also, of course, scared stiff in circumstances like that. There's a great deal at stake. Think of Joshua. The odds were overwhelmingly pitted against Joshua and his forces. We're not told how he felt, though we can probably guess. But we are told, significantly, about the unseen forces at work. Facing overwhelming odds in precisely these circumstances, Joshua received a renewed vision of the holiness of God. It's this unexpected figure who comes before Joshua, who reveals himself in verse 14 as the commander of the army of the Lord. I think it's a bit of a mystery. It reminds us of the special vision of God that Moses received in Exodus chapter 3 and the burning bush. And in a similar way, of course, it's a kind of commissioning. But we need to ask ourselves, who is this strange figure, the commander of the army of the Lord? Well, the Hebrew word sabah, which is translated here as the Lord's army, is most often used in the Old Testament specifically of the angels. If you're taking notes, then 1 Kings 22 and verse 19, Psalm 103, verses 20 to 21, and Psalm 148, verse 2, all use Zabah in precisely this way of the angelic army. And the word translated commander, which is the Hebrew word sar, again is used particularly in the book of Daniel in chapters 10 and 21 in connection with the angelic host. It's used most often throughout the Old Testament to refer to a prince commander. So, how does all that add up? We're dealing here with what the Old Testament writers frequently refer to as the angel of the Lord. That's the same angel of the Lord who spoke to Sarai, in those days, wife of Abraham in Genesis 16, to Hagar in Genesis 21, and to Gideon in Judges chapter 6. Who's the angel of the Lord? It's rich Hebrew language, and it's used to describe the ineffable experience of God making himself known in a special way and at special times to specific men and women in these days of the Old Testament, sometimes called a theophany by the theologians. And in a sense, it's a foretaste. It's a foretaste of God making himself fully and tangibly known in the person of Jesus Christ. In another sense, for Joshua, it's a commissioning. Most of all, it renewed his vision of the holiness of God. And we see that in his response to this encounter. In verse 14, Joshua fell on his face and worshipped. And we must ask the question, why? I want us to think again about his situation. Joshua is poised for what could turn out to be an immense physical and tactical struggle. And the issue is this. Is it in the end all down to Joshua? Does the conquest of this immensely pagan and warlike land of Canaan depend solely on his tactical skills alone? Who ultimately is going to give success to this project? Can you see at this point? Joshua needed to have his vision of the almightiness of God renewed. And time has not changed our own human and spiritual needs. We have no greater need today as a church family and as individuals than to renew our vision of God, his greatness, his power, his majesty and his authority, above all his holiness and his love. The message here is that the real battle, both for the conquest of the promised land and in all situations, the real battle is fought and won by God. We have our part to play, of course, and God undeniably requires certain responses from us. But Joshua, some 3,200 years ago, facing this immense conquest of Jericho, and ourselves in this capital city of London, as we near the end of the 20th century, we have exactly the same spiritual needs. We will never, never, never adequately face up to any challenge or hurdle, whether it be a personal crisis or an issue involving us as a church family, such as the restoration of the outside of our building here, which we're involved in at the moment. We will never adequately face up to any challenge or hurdle unless we renew our vision of God. God's holiness and his love are meant to be our inspiration. It's meant to drive us forward, and we see it above all focused in the cross of Christ, the immense passion of God's holiness and his love for us. So let me ask you, personally, do you need your vision of God's immense strength in these ways to be rekindled? I would ask you not to shirk the time that you need to spend with God for that to happen. Open your heart and open your eyes and see. For our vision of God is the basis of all our effectiveness for Christ. And without that vision, our horizons are dimmed and our expectations diminished. That's the first element. On the threshold of this immense hurdle of the conquest, Joshua received a renewed vision of the holiness of God. Second element I want to draw our attention to is equally important, and we turn from vision to dedication. So number two, Joshua dedicated himself wholeheartedly to the purposes of God. And we see that in Joshua's question at the end of verse 14, what does my Lord bid his servant? It's that word servant which is the key. It tells us that Joshua is prepared to give himself wholeheartedly to the service of God. It's all about dedication. Last Monday, as I'm sure you know, was an historic day in the financial world. At 9 a.m. on Monday morning, the stock exchange went high-tech, the much-trumpeted Big Bang. Well, we all know that the computer doesn't seem to be a total success, but the workforce down in Throgmorton Street do seem highly committed. And in fact, the commitment demanded of those who work for these city brokers is a very fascinating sidelight on this Big Bang story. On Monday, the Independent newspaper ran an A to Z guide to the Big Bang. Some of you probably will have seen it. Revealingly, the letter E was for eggs and bacon, which was defined as food which used to be eaten in the home but is now eaten in the office. Seems that business breakfasts are becoming all the rage. Well, like some of you, I can think of very few worse ways of spending the beginning of the day. But these changing patterns, they illuminate one fact above all. The business world is quite clear that commitment, especially of time, energy, resources, and talent, is indispensably necessary for real achievement. Nothing can be achieved without it, even if it means eating your toast at work. In the business world, commitment matters. Perhaps some of us have forgotten it's exactly the same spiritual principle at work in our church family life. Dedication to the purposes of God. Commitment of time, energy, resources, and talent equally is indispensably necessary for God's purposes to go forward. If you have a dried up vision of God, of course you won't be much concerned for God's purposes. They won't mean much to you. Dedication won't matter. Now, I don't know whether that's the explanation for our situation at All Souls at the moment. The fact that there are only 250 people involved in active Christian service at All Souls at the present time. Believe me, that's a shamefully small figure. When you consider that there are some 2,000 of us who worship here each Sunday and 1,000 of us are involved in fellowship groups. Now, the biblical idea of the body of Christ must mean that every single person is involved in some way or other. But at All Souls, 250 people out of this great crowd doing everything, or so it seems. In fact, everything is not being done. A lot is being done, but much of our ministry is creaking along. I think there's some danger that we're becoming a spectator church. Too many of us here, I say it with seriousness, are backside Christians. That's an offense to God. You tell me why it is we cannot get more people involved in the clubhouse and the welcome desk and the catering team and people to help with small groups. In fact, it's absolutely true we cannot persuade some of us to tidy our books after the church service on Sundays. So where is the real dedication throughout the church to Christ? If you care about God and his purposes, you know that nothing is achieved without dedication, without commitment. God is not asking anybody here to do the impossible. He knows what you have to do already. He knows you as a person. And like this man Joshua, from whom we are meant to learn, he only asks you to be available and to offer yourself. Now, I want to balance all this and give the other side of the picture, because there are a whole bunch of tremendous people in this church who, to my mind, are absolutely amazing in this dedication. Quite sadly, a number of them are far too committed. They're overcommitted because other people are not picking up the tasks. So I'm sure that God is much more concerned at this point for the lazy. I mean, people who are lazy about the things of God. You can be busy in other ways, but you could be lazy about God's concerns. I say all this to myself as much as I say it to anybody here. Our task, in the face of this example we have here in Joshua, is to ask, what can we learn? What can we learn from Joshua's experience of moving forward with God? And the text is clear. Joshua dedicated himself wholeheartedly to the purposes of God. He made himself available. He offered himself. Note his words. What does my Lord bid his servant? You see, we have to go back one step, and this is very important. Joshua's vision of God was renewed in the first place. The vision was renewed. And it's a very simple truth. When the vision is bright, the dedication will go deep and not otherwise. So, vision, dedication, and now finally, obedience. That's the third element. Joshua demonstrated a complete obedience to the requirements of God. And that's what the whole of this rest of this passage is about. It's a demonstration of God's requirement of obedience. Look at the detailed instructions the Lord gives to Joshua in chapter 6, verses 3 to 5. Chapter 6, verses 3 to 5, and I'll read them to you. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus you shall do for 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And on the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, the priests blowing the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him. Those are the detailed instructions given by the Lord. And Joshua and the people of Israel, it's very important to notice this, they carried them out to the letter, complete obedience to the requirements of God. If you've ever felt all this ceremonial, the marching and the trumpets and the shouting, sounds a little bit odd, even ludicrous, hardly the stuff of which normal battles are made, then I have to tell you, you're absolutely on target. All that marching up and down, it didn't actually win the battle, not in an absolute sense. We know that from the text, from verse 2 of chapter 6, because in verse 2 the Lord tells Joshua, "See, I have given into your hand Jericho with its king and mighty men of valor." And then he reiterates it later on. Do you see that not only was the battle the Lord's, but in a real sense, the battle was won before it was ever fought? "See, I have given into your hand Jericho with its king and mighty men of valor." It was won before it was ever fought. So we have to ask again, why all this detailed paraphernalia for those 7 days? It does sound ludicrous, all that marching and trumpets and shouting. It's a very important question again. And the answer? Well, it's to do with obedience. You may have seen those programs on BBC some months back on the paratroopers. It was mainly about the very vigorous training that the paratroopers require in the armed forces. You know, the first 3 weeks of basic training for a paratrooper is quite an eye-opener. They have to accomplish all kinds of seemingly irrelevant or even ridiculous tasks, like polishing rusty saucepans, which are left out in the rain overnight, or cleaning out the loos to a strict time schedule. What has it all got to do with parachuting, you may ask? And it's a fair question. It's simply that if you are going to be a paratrooper, you have to learn to do what you are told. Why? Well, it's simple. Because you have to learn when the man says jump, you jump. At that point, you have to trust that he knows best. No arguing, you just do it, don't you? So the people of God in all generations are equally involved in training. We are being fitted for God's task. In our church, in our work environment, in our family life, in our relationships, we have to learn to be obedient. Those walls at Jericho, they came tumbling down. They came tumbling down because of God's power. But the obedience demonstrated by Joshua and his people enabled them to be used in God's plans. They had to trust God and do as he said, or they would have been flattened. No doubt about it. And it went beyond that. If you think about it, it would have been useless for God to provide a land for the people to inhabit and for them simply to ignore his purposes. The people had to learn obedience if they were to be included in God's planning for the future. It was a training time for them. And for all of us here and now, it's just as much a training time. There will be times in our lives when we have to trust God for the very big issues which face us. There are plenty of forces at work in our world which will flatten us as far as usefulness to God's service is concerned. If we ignore God's requirements now, we will be useless in his service. So when we learn to be obedient, and we start with the small things always, and then we work upwards, it makes trust in those situations so much more possible. We must be clear and realistic. I shouldn't think there's anybody here who is that good at doing what they're told. None of us are that good at doing what we're told, especially when our own self-interest is put on the line. There are two sides to the coin. The one is that we are answerable to God for all that we are and all that we do. And the other is that God wants, indeed he longs, to include us fully in his plans for our lives. And Jesus, as you know, was specific on the matter. He said, "If you love me, you will obey my commandments." Obedience is something we have to learn. And we have to learn it day by day, starting with the small things and working upwards. So I want to leave us all with a question to ponder over. The question is this: where are the points of conflict in your life between your self-interest, and the interest of God? How are you conducting your relationships? How are you spending your money? How are you using your talents? They can all be used to glorify God. Or they can be designed to please you. That's the choice. So what are the issues of obedience to God and his will which actually face you individually as a person at the moment? And are you prepared to do something about it? For that is the more important side of the question. So here's the conclusion. The approach of an historical documentary aims to get underneath the immediate facts of the real events to the underlying issues, the unseen forces at work, and the lessons which can be learned. It is exactly the way that these events at Jericho have been recorded for us in this extremely important book of Joshua in the Old Testament. All this may have happened a long time ago, but God has not changed, and neither have our own human needs or the conflicts we face in our own lives. Like Joshua, for us, it is all a question of vision, dedication, obedience. Please don't get it back to front. We all have to remember to take one step back. The first task is to enlarge our vision of God, of his immense power and his greatness, which we see, of course, so vividly and completely in Jesus Christ. Then second, dedicate yourself wholeheartedly to God's purposes. And finally, get on. Get on with that obedience, that cooperation with God's requirements for your life. And you know what they are, and you are aware what the issues are for you today. Don't forget that you are in training. Obedience is the only way to move forward with God. That is the way par excellence to know God's strength and victory in all the hurdles and issues of our lives. Vision, dedication, and obedience. Joshua learnt it, and you and I must learn it as well. Let's pray. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said, "What does my Lord bid his servant?" Just a few moments of silence. Let's use the silence so that each of us can respond to God. And if there is a conflict in your life between God's interests and your own, then why not sort it out right now? Enlarge your vision. Dedicate yourself to God's purposes. And renew your obedience.